I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Because if we trained a general purpose pattern recognition system on neural data, we could then theoretically use very few data points to train on the specific tasks that we'd like to accomplish.
But then you can do is simulation, right? There's no analytical solution. And I don't think there will ever be an analytical solution to, you know, to the brain. See,
so
we have to attend a podcast.
To learn this. I know, it's hilarious.
All right. Welcome to STEMcast, a podcast from McGill iGEM with me, Sabrina Du, as your host for today. And so two individuals here with us today who can tell us a lot about the specific intersection of AI and neuroscience and how this space is fitting into a consumer market are McGill professors Adrian Pirash and Blake Richards. So Adrian is an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery at McGill, and Blake is an associate professor in the School of Computer Science and the Montreal Neurological Institute, as well as a core faculty member of MILA. They are two of the co-founders of Lamarck Labs, a company building AI foundation models based on neural signals to ultimately decode the human brain. Blake, Adrian, welcome to STEMcast.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Yes, hi.
So why don't we start at the beginning then? Rewinding all the way back to the start of your research careers, Blake, I hear you wanted to become a rave organizer at first. How did that plan lead to the establishment of Link Lab, and, you know, what's Link interested in today?
Well, the connection is simply that when I was indeed very young, I had dreams of being a party organizer. I threw a few parties with my friends, and then one night bit off more than I could chew. And after borrowing $20,000 from some pretty sketchy guys, my friend and I did not get enough people coming to our party, and we lost 14K that night. So I went to my dad and I said, look, I owe a lot of money to these sketchy guys. Can you bail me out? And he said, sure, on the condition that you go to university and actually apply yourself. So that's what I did. I still had to pay him back, for the record, but he gave me a loan on this condition. And it was then when I went into undergrad and started really putting myself at the task that I discovered that I really loved artificial neural networks and the study of neural computation.
And then now at Link Lab, what do you guys focus on?
So my lab is concerned with understanding general principles of intelligence that apply to any intelligent system, whether it be an artificial intelligence system or a brain. And the way that we do that is we do a combination of experimental modeling, theory, and data analysis in order to try to uncover general, let's say, constraints on learning and decision-making that will apply across these different classes of intelligent agent. The key here is, of course, that we do all this within a given mathematical framework. So in our case, we use the mathematical framework provided by artificial neural networks. So generally, we build models that consist of artificial neural networks that are either models of an attempt to model the brain or simply an attempt to build an intelligent system. And then we look at how those models learn. We study them both analytically and empirically. And we also try to relate their behavior to experimental data.
A lot of times when we talk about general principles of intelligence, a lot of people necessarily associate that with a need for some kind of memory storage, which is something that Adrian also works a lot on. So we have from Blake going from a rave to now general principles of intelligence. For you, Adrian, I heard that somehow a sleeping rat drew you into this world of computational neuro, or maybe not a sleeping rat, but.
Yeah. So as a background, like as a training on the, when I was an undergrad, I was studying mostly physics and chemistry, and I really liked it. However, I did not feel like the real passion for like pursuing, you know, research in this field, or perhaps actually I was not good enough in math or something. And actually I was deeply fascinated by AI, right at the time, where it was, you know, before the, you know, the deep learning revolution. And this is where actually I started myself. So, I moved from, you know, physics to, a master in cognitive science in Paris. And, it was fascinating for me. I was learning so much and I was working, you know, on actually models inspired by the brain to navigate environment, right? Basically in this lab, they were building robots with, you know, biomimetic kind of network, this is how they called it. And at some point they were like, someone, you know, advised me to say, look, you should go and visit this lab where, you know, they do actual recordings in rats so that you can see actually what's going on in vivo. And I was like, okay, you know, it doesn't hurt. And I had this meeting with like this kind of senior postdoc transitioning to a permanent position in this lab in Paris. And I visited the lab, and that's exactly the story you just told. You know, I entered the room, and you know, first thing it tells me is that, you know, be quiet, there's a rat sleeping. I was like, what? Okay. First time I was actually, I don't even think if I had ever seen a rat before, and there was actually a rat like full of wires, you know, in this flower pot, and I turn and I saw these two big screens, like, you know, full of waves, and it was amazing. It was amazing to see, and that was the first time I actually, you know, did something like that. That was the first time I was seeing it, and I immediately got, you know, I was mesmerized, and I dropped almost everything I was doing at the time, and I started my PhD with actually this person. I was his first PhD student, and so yeah, this is how it started. And actually, so interestingly, if you really want to know, it's like, you know, in my last year, kind of my project last year as an undergrad, that was like I was working on some models in physics that basically have served as a model for memory, the so-called spin glass models. And so I had read about the hippocampus, like the structure in the brain that is so important for memory. And I knew there was like some, like, you know, link that had been established, especially in the 80s, early 90s. So I knew a bit about all this, but suddenly I started to connect the dots in my head, and I was like, wow, okay. And this is what I want to do. And this, you know, question of like understanding how memories form in the brain, and especially the role of sleep in this process, is really what is basically keeping me awake at night, you know, and that basically drives me to work every single morning, and me being so driven by, like, you know, understanding this question. So many people are working on this question, of course, and there are many different ways of doing this. You can do like human studies, you can do studies in the fly and drosophila, you can do a lot of things. And what we do in the lab, so we study, you know, an animal model, rodents, mostly mice and rats. It's mostly an experimental lab. We collect data, even if we are strongly, you know, we have like also computational minds, like we think in terms of computation. And really the idea is to deconstruct this whole process of like memory formation during sleep, from the bottom up, like trying to understand what are the building blocks of all these processes during sleep, trying to understand, like, we see these neurons, they are spontaneously active, they replay previous memory, but to understand exactly what it starts and how this signal emerge. And that's basically one of the big questions in the lab. It's not the only question, because, you know, we address, you know, these systems in many different ways, but that's really, I guess, like, still my, like, the main focus of my work and of what is going on in the lab, generally speaking.
What's really cool about that is when you're talking about hippocampal replay and hippocampal representations, one of the things I first noticed that came from both of your labs was David Levenstein's work on hippocampal replay and hippocampal representations in artificial neural networks. And so I kind of wanted to know how your collaborations began and what they look like now.
That's an interesting question. I'm trying to remember, Adrian, do you remember where we actually met? I'm struggling
Yeah.
to come
Oh,
up with.
I can tell the story actually because
Okay.
it's a funny one. So the first time we met is actually when you interviewed at McGill,
Right.
and I remember people were talking about this interview like, oh, Blake Richards is interviewing here, all right. And the only thing I really knew about you was like actually your Twitter at the time. And I remember there was like some talk between like, our generation at TI. It's like, is this actually guy, what is this guy like? Because we all knew him through like basically like social networks. Like basically, but is it the a real like is it real? Is it like is, or is it just like, talking on social network? And I remember like your talk and then talking to you in my office, like I don't know, like for 45 minutes, and then basically texting a few friends here say, no, this guy is genuine. Like this is really solid.
That's amazing. I'm so glad you remember that. The funny thing is, for me, part of the reason it's obscure in my mind is that I don't know if I ever told you this, Adrian, but I spent my postdoc obsessing over some of your papers, actually.
Really?
In particular, because I was doing work on memory consolidation in Paul Franklin's lab, and I was also doing a project with a student there looking at the coupling of spindles and ripples during sleep.
Yeah,
And so,
Frances, right?
yeah, so obviously some of your work on looking at those couplings was a big part of our discussions.
That's funny. You never told me that. That's funny.
Yeah.
See,
So in
we
my
have to
mind,
attend a podcast. We have to participate in the podcast to hear that.
to learn this, I know it's hilarious, but in my mind, I had always known you, and that's why I was sort of confused. I was like,
But it's the same for me. I felt like I always knew you like through social
yeah.
network and some of your work also. But like suddenly you put a face, like okay. So and but in reality, I guess like it's about like, quite a couple of years after you started here that we applied together on the first seed grant from Healthy Brain HBHL initiative.
Yes.
And I was like a small grant on like actually it was not that small. To try some new analytical data processing techniques for something very specific, and you had some ideas where I was starting to collect some data, and it didn't really work out in the end, the specific project, but this is when we actually started to work together. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And so this indeed was a grant on doing calcium imaging analysis. And we did some work on that together, but really where our work together ended up going, to finally sort of get to the final part of your question, Sabrina, is courtesy of a postdoc that we decided to jointly supervise, a guy named Daniel Levenstein. We've been doing a lot of work over the last couple of years on trying to understand what sorts of training regimes could actually produce the type of replay that's seen in the hippocampus during rest. And this gets back to the original point about general purpose findings. Like, in a very general purpose model, what types of training regimes lead to the type of replay we see in the brain?
And going back to your previous question, Sabrina, the funny thing about this project is that this is somehow what I was trying to do as a master's student 20 years ago. Let's face it was 20 years ago. And I was like, I was frustrated because I was connecting all these neurons by hand. I was building it, myself. And I was not super satisfied. And I think at the time I was like, actually, I remember I was thinking like this is not how the brain actually built it. Like these all these connections, they are not there in the genome. They are basically they emerge, they are learned, they are what the develop, whatever. But I left this feel like with this frustration of like this is there's no way we're gonna understand it anytime soon. We need to collect data, and I need to understand it in vivo. And 20, like 15 years later, this is when I started to work on this again, with Dan. And yes, like suddenly, after years of work, we're like, wow, we have now some principles that can tell us how this phenomena, you know, emerge in the hippocampus and the brain, and it's still fascinating to me.
I think one of the key things, Adrian, that you just said was this is not how the brain does it. We don't know how the brain does it because it's a parallel distributed processing system. There's an enormous number of parallel computations. And so the question I have for you guys now is, can you explain why, on the contrary, now we see the rise of these artificial intelligence models, how those are useful or well positioned to analyze neural data and really tell us how does the brain do it?
Well, so there's maybe two different things to unpack there. I think that there is the initial question of how can we actually analyze neural data given its immense complexity? And it is complex precisely because, as you said, the brain is a parallel distributed processing system. So there are all these computations going on in parallel, distributed across a huge number of neurons. And even though we're getting better and better at recording larger and larger numbers of neurons in behaving animals, it's still very hard. Even if you had the activity of every neuron in the brain, how do you actually do something with that? How do you analyze that in a way that reveals something about how the system's working? Now, I think that when it comes to analyzing that data to achieve specific technical ends, such as decoding what a person is thinking, perhaps to let them control a computer if they're paralyzed, for example, or trying to determine whether someone's at risk for a given disease or predict whether they're going to respond to different types of treatments for a psychiatric disorder, et cetera, is that, you know, we could use AI models to analyze the data, and we probably will have to, because traditional statistical techniques will not be up to the task of analyzing these extremely complex, high-dimensional data sets taken from these parallel distributed networks in the brain. Now, that technology will allow us to achieve these specific goals, but it won't necessarily actually tell us how the brain works. And for that, we probably still need to actually be building artificial neural network models that attempt to replicate how the brain works more directly at an algorithmic level, and then compare those models to experimental data. So I think that there's a two-pronged approach here, one which will help us have practical impact in neuroscience, and one which will help us to actually better understand the brain.
Yeah, and I totally agree with, you know, what Blake just said. And I think it's important to keep in mind that there's no one solution. It's not just AI that will solve, you know, the brain by just understanding the data without us understanding anything. And it's not just by putting electrodes in the brain or like microscope that we're gonna also understand how it works. Like it has to be a dialogue, basically, trying to understand. And really, we need to understand the principle. We need to understand like some, you know, rules that basically explain what we observe at the macroscopic level, like at the level of, for example, like a network at the hippocampus, for example, right? And you need the data. You need to collect the data in certain ways. You need also the models. And at some point, you will need also some algorithm to make sense of the data, because there will be, you know, one individual. You can have rules that explain, you know, the hippocampus across mammals and species. It's not because you have this rule that you're going to understand like one specific individual. You'll have to train specific ways to basically understand like decode something from this individual. And yes, you need to think complex necessarily. This is a complex system, like in which, you know, you have certain properties that emerge. And it's important to always keep in mind that even if physics is, you know, so far ahead in terms of like theory and explaining the universe, but still, you know, you have quantum, you know, mechanics, which is great, it's amazing, but you cannot basically explain anything above like more complicated than the atom of like the hydrogen atom, because then it's like there's no analytical solution to it. We know the rules and the principles are true, But then you can do is simulation, right? There's no analytical solution. And I don't think there will ever be an analytical solution to, you know, to the brain. And even more complicated than this, there's no like one general principle in the brain. Like it's like region specific, species specific. There's like all these little differences that yes, you can have perhaps some rules about like a cortical column, but the same rules will not apply to the basal ganglia and the cerebellum. And there are so many different worlds depending on like also at which level you observe the system. Is it like we're talking about the synapse, the cell body? Do you know the network, the signal generator? So makes it fascinating, and you know, we're gonna have jobs like, you know, for many, many more years thanks to the complexity of the system.
Then I guess what I'm more curious about now is, since quote unquote decoding the brain is something that Lamarck puts on as its messaging, right? And so I was wondering if you guys can then introduce a bit what your goals are with Lamarck and what you mean then by decoding the brain.
Yeah, so perhaps I should start on this and providing you with some context. It all started actually a year ago, and with, you know, my good friend Nathan Guetta. He's not a scientist. He's been basically working in business for the last 20 plus years, you know, super tech savvy. And the first question we had was really about sleep. And because there's so much to understand about sleep and there's so much monitoring that needs to be improved and like so many different things, I'd be happy to discuss if you'd like. And very quickly we were like, look, all the solutions have been provided so far, have been developed, failed at some level because, as I was saying before, they fail to adapt to this new individual. They work great, for example, on a certain training set with a certain device, but it doesn't generalize. Doesn't generalize well beyond, you know, the training set. And quickly, basically, we had this idea, like, and it's still kind of a buzzword, right? But like, we need a foundational model for that. And as we were having this discussion and, you know, we were touching base with some of our friends in AI and discussing whether there was an opportunity here, I was like, look, Nathan, I really have to talk to my friend and colleague, you know, Blake, because he's been thinking about foundation model in neuroscience for a couple of years. I know that because, you know, like Blake had invited me to a meeting he had organized at Mila, really to discuss and review the state of the art on this front, like what it was 2022, right? I guess, or 2021. Anyway,
that was 2022, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and so yeah, one day I and actually at the time last year, also perhaps important to give it the context. I took a sabbatical year and I was basically spending half of my time at Mila in Blake's lab, and. And one day I knock on Blake's door and say, you know, can we talk for 5 minutes? And I expose him the idea. And this is when basically Blake joined us and we started to think about this whole project. And the idea is like, what do we need? What do we really want to do? And why it should be like a spin-off and not just like an academic, yet another academic project, right? So this is where it started. Still, you know, it's not easy. And Blake can tell more perhaps now, but that's the context and this is how it started.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only thing I'd add to that is, you know, so indeed I had gotten really excited about the potential for using AI to do neural decoding and other related tasks. Once the implications of foundation models in AI had become clear. Because for a long time, I was sort of skeptical of the idea because when you're doing standard deep learning with supervised training, which is what most of us had been doing in the 2010s, what you're going to get is a situation where it's impossible to get a big enough data set because having a labeled data set of sufficient size is basically impossible. Like if you want, for example, a data set of, you know, whether or not someone's going to respond to a given, like what someone's thinking, for example, how many times can you ask someone to think of a given letter and then record their brain activity? you know, if you're lucky and you've got someone really patient, maybe they'll do this 1,000 times for you. But deep learning systems require ideally billions or even trillions of data points to really learn effective models. And so I was very skeptical that we would ever be able to do much with these systems for neuroscience. But over the last 5 years, people started to develop these quote unquote foundation models, which are pre-trained models that are pre-trained in a self-supervised manner, meaning that they're just trained to predict parts of the input data from itself. And in doing that, you can train a model on oodles and oodles of data, even if they don't share similar labels, such as what letter was the person thinking of, or what was their disease category, et cetera. You can just take any neural recording you want and input it into the model. So as Adrian said, I got excited about this idea a couple of years ago. I organized a workshop on it. I even started to put together a program at Ivado on building foundation models for neuroscience. And then after all this stuff, I was still starting to wonder whether or not it might make sense to do something in the private sector this way. And that's when Adrian approached me and said, I've got a friend who wants to create a startup in this area. You know, maybe you can be part of this. And so I came on as an advisor to Lamarck Labs.
What I find really interesting about what you just said was the idea that you thought we didn't have, at first, we didn't have enough data in order to train a certain model to accomplish a specific task. Am I getting that correct? For neuroscience, like an artificial intelligence model for neuroscience specifically?
Yeah, like we will basically never have enough data to train a model on a specific task and only that task, or at least not to get it as effective a model as one would really want.
I say that because one of the podcasts that I listened to that I believe you were on, I think it was the Super Data Science podcast, you specifically mentioned a quote about, I think it was like Hyland's quote, right, about how specializations is for insects.
Yes.
Is it the one that's on your wall? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And so for the people listening right now, who maybe aren't that familiar with what AI foundation models are, and the idea that they're very, very general, since you were talking about how the neural data isn't specific, they could have nothing to do with each other, right? How that is beneficial for what you envision these models to be used for later.
Yeah, so I think the key point here is that in order to really do something like brain decoding or disease prediction or whatever, your model needs to understand something about the patterns that exist in neural activity. The trouble is that when you do, so you need to learn about the patterns that exist in the neural activity, and standard deep learning approaches that use a supervised signal are good at discovering patterns in data. But they do so optimally only when you reach really, really large amounts of data. As I said, it's unlikely that for a given task, you'll ever get to the amounts of data that you would want in neuroscience to train one of these models. So, you know, for example, even the earliest deep learning systems that were doing image recognition, so they were being trained to categorize images into different categories, dog, plane, apple, et cetera. Those models only got effective once we started training them on millions of images. And they only got really effective when we started training them on billions of images. Now, as I said, the likelihood that you're ever going to collect neural data that contains millions of data points that all have the same labels applied to them, so that you can do this supervised learning where you say, okay, here's some neural data, and here's what the person was thinking of, decode this. The chances that you're going to get a big enough data set of that kind of data is very unlikely. But people are doing neural recordings all the time. So there's, you know, many, many, many thousands of neural recordings out there. And in principle, if you could train on all of them, then you would maybe have enough data for a deep learning system. But to do that, you've got to not train the model on any specific task. And this is the core idea behind a foundation model. Don't train a specific model. Don't train it to do a specific thing. Rather, train it to be a general purpose pattern recognition system. And then once you've trained this general purpose pattern recognition system, you will be able to more rapidly learn specific tasks, because the reason that deep learning systems require so much data is precisely because it's that pattern recognition that requires so much data. Once you've already identified the patterns in the data, it's now very easy to go from the specific patterns to specific outputs. So, for example, in language processing, if you try to train a system to do translation, let's say you try to train a system to translate from English to Icelandic. I picked this just because it was an example that was used in one of Google's early papers on this. If you try to train a system to translate from English to Icelandic, to actually get a good translation system, you would need billions of sentences that have been translated by humans from English to Icelandic or vice versa. But what you can do instead, and this is what people do nowadays, is you start by building a foundation model that's simply trained to recognize the patterns in English. So it recognizes the grammar of English, for example, and it does so purely by predicting the next word in a sentence or missing words in a sentence, etc. Once you've trained that general purpose model that recognizes the patterns in English, now you can actually train the system to translate English to Icelandic with very few example data points. And that's where things get potentially interesting for neuroscience. Because if we trained a general purpose pattern recognition system on neural data, we could then theoretically use very few data points to train on the specific tasks that we'd like to accomplish.
So in a way, remember how we were saying how decoding the brain requires almost that you replicate the brain? What I'm hearing from this is a lot of times we associate human intelligence with our ability to generalize. We're great generalists, right?
Yep.
And here you are building an AI foundation model for neuroscience, a general purpose model that understands. Now, Adrian, I'm going to shoot this question to you. What do you envision this general purpose model then being specified to? What kind of applications, I guess? There's some that are named on Lamarck's information platforms already, but I was wondering what both of you saw as the future applications of what you're building.
That's a great question, because actually, you know, the potential applications are almost infinite. There are use cases that are kind of obvious right now, but when you think deeply about it, you know, when it comes to basically interacting with hardware, like external devices, I mean, there's no limit imagining what you can do with that. It's a bit scary as well, right? We're not, you know, mad scientists. We know also the potential, you know, danger of this kind of technology. We're fully aware of that, you know, we have to be careful, like with the way these things are developed. I want to say it, like, you know, for a thing, because it's a big debate right now. How much we're gonna have access, you know, eventually to our inner thoughts and like our inner brain activity. But you know, of course, basically, I would say there are three main use cases. One is clinic. EEG is cheap to collect, to monitor. You know, most hospitals in the world, like even third world country, like having an EEG machine is not, you know, it's not impossible. It doesn't cost much. And there's so much we think and many people believe you can do with like EEG recording. Like, and I say, sorry, when I say EEG, electroencephalography, basically the electrical wave pattern you can record through the skull. It's non-invasive. And so it's pretty cheap. You know, this technology is like more than a century old now. But there's so much you can do. You can, like, and what was the core question at first, and then before we kind of pivoted, but like sleep, like the detecting, you know, pathological sleep patterns and trying to understand, like, you know, what can be the origin of that, or like doing some, you know, diagnostic and prognosis of certain disease, looking at sleep patterns. So that's one big thing. And sleep, you know, think about the in the OR, like, you know, like monitoring consciousness level as someone is under surgery or like many other disease or basically the effect of drugs, including you want to do like large scale, you know, clinical trials. And basically, sure, one readout of the effect of the drugs is basically not only the report you're going to have from the patient or like physiological signals, is also like, you know, how it affects, you know, brain activity overall, because perhaps there's many things here that you cannot detect elsewhere on other physiological signals or just verbal report from the subject. So all this, basically, this huge amount of things that can be done. On the other extreme, I'd say it's like all the brain-computer interface. It could be like somehow also in the clinic space, like, you know, exoskeleton or like, you know, prosthetics, you need to basically, you know, command like an artificial arm, for example. Why not? We can do that, or give back, like, you know, speech to aphasic patients. Of course, this is something that many people are working on, and why not? You could decode some of it from directly from the EEG. But there's also all the brain computer interface. Like, why can we imagine in the future that we'll be interacting directly with our smartphones, you know, through like some EEG channel, and basically be able to do some action? Perhaps very simple ones, but we don't even have to, you know, use our fingers, which will help me tremendously, you know, during winter in Montreal when I'm outside and I have to basically get rid of my gloves to actually do some very basic action on my phone. So all these are possibilities. And but again, what is important here is, as Blake was saying, what you need first, you need this very general purpose, you know, model of brain signal that understand like dynamics across individuals, across like the you know, the larger, you know, diversity, the larger diversity of also of human beings, you know, whatever we're coming from and whatever the age, and understanding like our individual also patterns, and then basically fine-tuning this model to all these application, right? And this is something that requires a lot of resource, of course. Blake was saying, we need a lot of data for that, but it's doable, and this is something which will potentially be achieved one day. Yeah.
Funny enough, when you were mentioning about EEGs early enough, it's this general tool that you can use for a lot of different things. EEGs were, I think, first used in the 1930s by Alfred Loomis, right? It was almost 100 years ago. And now 100 years later, there's this new wave of more computational software tools to be handling the vast amounts of neural data that is coming our way. And you touched on this a bit, Adrian, of the idea that we have to be careful because with great benefits also comes great risks. And so I wanted also to continue on this look towards the future and ask the both of you about what excites you and I guess worries you the most with the technologies that you guys are developing.
Perhaps I can start because, you know, really to me, even if I'm excited by many potential applications, it's really the idea that, you know, we will be able to monitor people's health at home continuously, you know, longitudinally. I mean, this is something we start to see with, you know, smart watches, with like all these smart rings that collect a lot of physiological data. But these are, you know, a lot of, it's not really clinic grade, you know, it's like, it's never been fully also, you know, how to say, tested and validated by the clinic and research community, but it will get there. And these EEG recordings, you know, during sleep or during wake, will eventually tell us a lot about like our global health and, you know, if things are fine. And because, you know, sometimes we're in denial self also about our own mental health, for example. And you know, these signals will basically provide us with some feedback, say, look, there's some problem here. You need to rest. You need to calm down, or, you know, you need to exercise, perhaps, or something. Like, you know, having like these external sorts of signals that basically can help us. And also it will democratize, you know, a lot of diagnostic that today only very wealthy countries can afford. You know, you have so many people that have like true sleep disorders. For example, again, I'm talking about sleep, but it's true for all the aspects, but for sleep disorders, like today, if you go to a hospital and to get like a full night of sleep, it costs like a tremendous, you know, like it has a very big cost for the for the society, because you have to spend a whole night in the hospital and someone has to analyze the data. What actually could all be automatized, you know, and done at home. And wherever you're coming from, like all this should be available. So yeah, the future is bright, and you know, on this regard, and it's a lot about like democratizing, you know, a lot of these the access to this kind of diagnostic, these technologies, and you know, improving health or you know, overall, I guess.
Well, one of the things that I'm excited about as a broader question is actually just seeing all of the advances that we've been making in neuroscience with, you know, better recording technologies and things like that, actually pay off in terms of practical applications. Neuroscience has received a great deal of funding from governments around the world over the last few decades. And to date, it's been tough to point to specific contributions that we've made to the improvement of people's lives. There are a few examples. Deep brain stimulation is one of them. But there should be a lot more, I would say, given the amount of money invested. And these models will, in my opinion, in the long run, really make neurotechnology for both clinical and non-clinical purposes commercially viable. And that's when we're going to see the sort of actual payout from these investments that governments have made. And that, I think, will be really wonderful, because it will help reinforce the cycle of like, yes, you should be investing in brain science. It's a useful thing to invest in, etc. I'm also just generally kind of like excited by the idea of, you know, better understanding the codes inside the brain and being able to relate those to the codes that we see in artificial neural networks, because I'm interested in these questions of general purpose intelligence. Now, in terms of the other part of your question about like, what do I fear? I mean, one of the things that I would worry about is that in the long run, if we have really good brain decoding methods, and they were used by people with very few scruples, you know, you could imagine all sorts of unethical uses of these technologies down the road. Now, generally speaking, I think any unethical use of such a technology will still require that someone, you know, has a recording device put on their head somehow. Which, if we're talking about any kind of, you know, reasonably democratic society, then is probably not a big concern. But you could easily imagine situations where people have their brain activity forcibly recorded and then various things decoded from their brain without their volition. And that's really concerning. That's all very long term, but it's still something we should be talking about now for thinking about future regulatory mechanisms.
I'm excited to see that you guys have a very, very like optimistic and positive vision for where the technology is going. And I think a lot of the listeners are really going to resonate with that. So thank you so much for joining me on this episode of STEMcast. And thank you, listeners, for joining us.